The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
According to journalists I've spoken to in a variety of different language services, it has served as an inhibitor from the kind of robust coverage without fear that they thought they might be able to do. It means that every time they're going to put up a tweet or something on Facebook or some other service or on their regular broadcast, they have to think hard. Do I need to have somebody rebut every element of a contention? If I'm doing an interview back and forth, is it enough that I'm pressing somebody on his or her claims, or do I have to have somebody else in that same segment? And while fairness is something for which all newsrooms should strive, and one which is by law mandated for Voice of America, the people enforcing that, you know, shouldn't be non-journalists if one puts any stock in the statutory and legislative protections that are supposed to be shielding Voice of America and its sister networks.
I'm Margaret Taylor, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, October 21st, 2020. While everyone's attention has been focused on the coronavirus and the run-up to the 2020 election, a lot has been happening at the U.S. Agency for Global Media, which oversees a number of government-funded entities, including the Voice of America. Michael Pack, a conservative filmmaker, was confirmed as the head of the Agency for Global Media in June, after much controversy on Capitol Hill. Once installed, Pack gutted the top leadership and took actions critics say breached the firewall meant to protect these various overseas news outlets from politicization. He held back congressionally appropriated funds and even defied a bipartisan congressional subpoena for his testimony. Investigations have been opened and lawsuits have been filed. I sat down with NPR's David Folkenflik to sort it all out. It's the Lawfare Podcast, October 21st, Fear and Loathing at the U.S. Agency for Global Media. So, David, I want to start with the basics, because I don't think the Lawfare listeners have had a podcast totally dedicated to specifically the U.S. Agency for Global Media. So let's start there. What is the USAGM? And if you could just incorporate the former name of it, which I think more of our listeners actually will know.
Sure. And it would be a very specialized podcast if you had on a regular basis routinely devoted a full hour or full session to USAGM, as it's abbreviated. It used to be run under the name of the Broadcasting Board of Governors. It's gone through a number of iterations over the years, and it's been assigned to under various agencies over the years, most recently sort of under the sway of the State Department. But as it segued to being led instead of by a board, but to an empowered CEO in recent years, it's become more independent. So this is the agency that oversees at its core the Voice of America and other federally funded international broadcasters, including Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, Radio Free Asia, Middle East broadcast networks, an office devoted solely to broadcasting in Cuba, Radio TV Marti, things like that. The Open Technology Fund, which is an outfit designed to sponsor and foster and encourage innovation so that people living in repressive regimes can have access to the internet sort of unexpurgated, unfiltered, uncensored, and also can have secure ways to communicate to one another. So among the things they helped to underwrite was the development of Tor technology, allowing people to download things, and Signal, the confidential communication service. And these not only serve as conduits to communication, but also in some places like Iran, I'm told that the vast majority of consumers of, I believe it's the VOA Iranian service, is done through Signal itself. That is, this, it ends up being a platform for their news services. So you're seeing, taken together, these outfits essentially provide to the world an understanding of American political debate and cultural debate and discourse, and is sort of a form of soft power that is representing American ideals by providing reliable journalism and news you can trust, whether it's positive or negative for America, whether it's positive or negative for the countries that are being covered, and also often replacing an absent free press in those countries where the ruling figures don't allow journalists to operate freely. So it's sort of a very layered and subtle mission folded in, stimulated in significant part by the establishment of the Voice of America during World War II to provide reliable news to people behind the Axis curtain.
So I want to talk a little bit more about the mission, because I think for Americans who are accustomed to thinking of media outlets as things that are separate from the government, for example, NPR is separate from the government, these entities are not in the same way. And so just walk us through a little bit more about the mission of these various entities. What is the U.S. government trying to achieve by, you know, setting these up and funding them through Congress year after year?
Right. Well, this is soft power. We're trying to say this is American value. The idea of a free press, the idea of a robust press that we will reflect a fractious debate in America. You know, when the Voice of America was established, as I mentioned, during World War II, one of the things that they did was project allied losses as well as allied victories. And that meant that people listening to it in Germany and Italy and all these lands that had been conquered by the Nazis trusted what was happening on Voice of America far more than they would any propaganda or reports being put out by their own side, by the collaborationist governments with the Nazis that were papering over when the Allies were making advances. And the idea is that this also segued during the Cold War to provide people behind the Iron Curtain with the understanding that American culture involved good and bad, that American culture and news involved reflecting the facts fairly. And that just built trust, and it made a brand for America as a place where democracy lived its ideals to a significant extent and where you could trust journalism. And so, yeah, you know, there's this weird thing going on where we think of government-sponsored news as being kind of propaganda. But as the BBC has shown, there can be government-backed broadcasting that has standards and a notion of impartiality and fairness that can model for people in other countries what journalism and what civic discourse can look like. So this is a form of diplomacy where you do well by doing good.
So that takes us, you used the word diplomacy, that takes us to what I want to kind of tell our listeners is why the Lawfare podcast is looking at this topic and what's been going on at the U.S. Agency for Global Media. I was a staffer on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee for years, and that's where I became most familiar with the BBG, really. It was the BBG back then. So there is congressional oversight over this agency. And the now head of the U.S. Agency for Global Media, Michael Pack, had an interesting time, I'd say, getting through the Senate after he was nominated by President Trump. First of all, who is Michael Pack? Why was he nominated for this position by President Trump? And then if you could tell us a little bit about the difficulties he encountered up in the Senate after he was nominated.
Sure. I mean, this is an agency that oversees a workforce of probably several thousand people. And this is far vaster an enterprise than Michael Pack has ever run before. He was, for a little time, the head of the Claremont Institute, a conservative think tank out in California. He has been an official at the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and close to 30 years ago, he oversaw what ended up evolving into the video and television arm of Voice of America. So, you know, he's a documentary maker, clearly comes from a conservative point of view, has made some well-regarded documentaries, some of which aired on PBS and other outlets. You know, one was able to get the very rare full sit-down interview with Justice Clarence Thomas, notably hermetic in his public utterances. So this is a figure who's conservative and yet has been in media circles for quite some time. What PAC's nomination consisted of was, it seemingly, you know, President Trump nominated him in, I believe, 2018, and there it languished. And it languished because people had questions about some of his past work. They had questions about ultimately whether or not he had adequately followed not-for-profit tax law. He had both a for-profit wing, and with his wife, he had a non-profit wing from which he solicited grants, and seemed as though the claim was made, or concerns were raised by officials in District Columbia, that he was funneling some of these grants to his for-profit arm. And his appointment languished. And it was revived seemingly this past April, when the White House went after the Voice of America for posting what turned out to be Associated Press stories about China and the coronavirus that were, to the White House's take, insufficiently blaming the Chinese for the spread and eruption of the pandemic abroad, and particularly the United States. And they accused it of essentially posting propaganda. And a dormant nomination suddenly became an important one for the White House again, interestingly, shortly after the arrival of Chief of Staff Mark Meadows. And then on Capitol Hill, they had this question. Republicans who led the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, were they going to go to bat for the president on someone who was not a priority for them? Republicans, Marco Rubio, Lindsey Graham, and others have expressed some concerns about PAC, even as he was entering the job. It took a pretty heavy lift to get him through the Senate Foreign Relations Committee on a party line vote in early June, and he took office a couple of days later.
And you've done such great work on this topic. You've covered it so closely. Is it the case that there's an open investigation by the District of Columbia Attorney General into whether he funneled those funds from his nonprofit group to his for-profit film company? Is that an open investigation now?
It appears to be open investigation currently by, as I understand it, local prosecutors in the District of Columbia, who, of course, are federal because it's a federal district. But I believe that is an ongoing investigation, the resolution of which we are not certain of.
Yeah, so I just want to comment, and this is one of the reasons I was interested in doing this as a podcast, this topic. You know, when I did vetting of nominees on the Foreign Relations Committee, and the idea that the committee would take up and pass through committee someone who had an open investigation on them, to me it's kind of unthinkable. Nothing even close to that happened when I was up there, which says to me, this nominee must have been very important to the president. I think I read in some of the coverage that President Trump actually mentioned this to Senate Republicans at a lunch or something like that, that the need to get him through committee. Is that your understanding too, that the president was personally involved in making sure that Michael PAC got a vote in the Senate?
It's my understanding the White House at the highest level conveyed that. I think it's a mystery to people on the Hill precisely why this picked up so much steam after basically kind of petering out for 2 years. I think PAC felt as though he was in a particularly vicious purgatory for 2 years. And to be specific, I may have spoken earlier, it's the DC Attorney General who's been investigating the nonprofit. But Trump made clear that he was angered by the Voice of America. You know, it's not an agency that typically draws a lot of presidential attention. But when you saw those denunciations from the White House put out, I mean, it wasn't just that they did it. It's that they made sure people were aware of it. They put it on their website. They sent it out to reporters. Trump denounced the Voice of America again in May. He underlined and underscored for the Senate Republicans that he was placing a priority on this. It was not just something that someone in some tiny cubicle somewhere in the White House cared about. The president was putting himself behind this. And I think it was a lot of surprise to a lot of Republicans on the Hill that they were going to have to take this up if they wanted to do the president's bidding on this.
The vote was fairly recent. He was confirmed recently. I believe it was June. Mm-hmm. He was then headed over to the U.S. AGM. And why don't you tell us sort of how that was received over there and what he kind of did when he got there?
Well, so you saw two things happen. First, he had made clear that he wanted to, in some ways, embody Trumpism at the US AGM. For better or for worse, whatever you think of it, you know, he saw the animating principle being that the media was part of a resistance, that there were folks inside federal bureaucracies, but particularly inside media, who were part of a deep state. And when you take that into combination, you know, it seems to me in retrospect hard not to conclude that Michael Pack indeed was trying to use USAGM as a showcase for what Trumpism would look like. So, you know, he has a not unsophisticated understanding of what media can do. And at the same time, he was using a fairly unsophisticated approach in the sense that he was using a bludgeon to essentially beat down or drive off people who in any way might take a different approach than he would. Why do I say that? Well, look, coming in, he had folks who served as what were called Sherpas to help him guide through the nomination processes that you had been involved with in the in your past Senate life, right? And he then had a couple of folks assigned to him by the White House. We're talking about Trump aides who worked for people like Mick Mulvaney in the White House, who were seemingly loyal Trump aides who were there to help him, what's called onboard, help him get up to speed, help tell him, here's the lay of the land, here are the people in various jobs, here's what they do, here's what seems to work, here's some questions we've come up with in the time that we've been trying to prep for your arrival. He had those people help to lay off or fire a bunch of people pretty much from his first time inside the Cohen building, which is where the headquarters is of the agency and the Voice of America. And then he had those people laid off also. That is the people who were there to help him fire others because they had preceded him, even though just by a couple days or weeks or months in that agency, and he didn't trust them.
So essentially, it sounds like what you're saying is he went in and he kind of fired or let go all of the top people that had been there. Is that the norm for what happens when a new head of this agency or the prior agency comes in? Like, is this new and different from what has gone on in the past? Or is this something that happens when a new head of this agency comes in?
Now, put it this way, I've covered media for over 20 years now, 16 of them just about at NPR. And I have covered controversies involving the predecessor agencies to USAGM before. I've never seen anything like this in my life. The head of the Voice of America, Amanda Bennett, and her deputy both resigned a couple of days before he formally took office. And then he went and lopped off the heads of all the other broadcasters and agencies. And one of them, Bei Fang, for example, respected journalist who had served as a diplomat, was the head of Radio Free Asia. She had something in her contract that allowed her to go back to be executive editor. That is the top journalist within the newsroom of Radio Free Europe, rather than the president of the agency, right, of the broadcaster. And therefore, theoretically beyond his reach in terms of how that worked. He then had her fired as executive editor also. He went and reached in and really lopped off the heads of these agencies, of these broadcasters, before they had a chance to talk to him about their vision for what they wanted to do, had a chance to listen to what his priorities might be, and a chance to suggest how they might do that. It is the case that, you know, cabinet secretaries, agency chiefs are, by and large, allowed to set priorities and figure out who they want in positions. The idea that he would essentially decapitate all of these broadcasters at once and then proceed in a series of weeks to decide that he was going to effectively flush out almost all of his top executive staff too, was pretty astonishing. And what's documented is that he did so in response to a number of them saying, hey, you can't do this because of this law or that regulation or this process has to be followed. And he simply didn't want to hear it. So among the things he did was he didn't talk to these people more than a minute or two here or there, and he certainly didn't listen. And while not listening is perhaps a personal failing rather than a professional rallying cry for eviction, what it amounts to is that he's run roughshod over the agency. People inside tell me in vast numbers that he's run roughshod over the agency's mission. And there are, I think, credible allegations he's run roughshod over the law as well, some of which we've pointed out at NPR. It's quite an intense, if brief, tenure he's had since taking over in June.
And has he put new people into these positions where he fired or other people were sort of leaving before he was coming in?
Such a good question. Look, if we fire up the interwebs right now, right, let's do that together. I'm going to go to their homepage and their website. And there's a reason I'm doing this rather than simply wasting your time. It's because if you go to the Who We Are section and you're trying to figure out who is the management team, there's just a lot of holes there. you know, or at least there has been. They've got acting. I'm looking at the Voice of America, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, which is run under the same thing, Office of Cuba Broadcasting, Radio Free Asia, and the Middle East Broadcasting Network. Each one of them has an acting president. Ellis Bibaraj, the acting director of the Voice of America, used to be head of their Albanian service, and then there's sort of that part of Europe he oversaw before being elevated after Amanda Bennett resigned. He's been the acting director since June. That's, 4 months he's been there in an acting service, which means he's very much at the daily pleasure of the CEO without any sense of permanence. And that's true for these other positions as well. If you try to figure out who's, you know, the chief strategy officer, who's the chief legal officer, it's just not there. Like, and when you're trying to figure out who's running their news shop, for a significant period of time, it was a guy who used to be Bill Barr, that is Attorney General Bill Barr's speechwriter. He came over to do this job. He decided apparently he didn't want to be handling news anymore. He was never listed online in that function. You'd never know. You just send things to a generic email. But it means it's hard to know who you're supposed to talk to at any given time. I believe his deputy chief of staff for the moment has taken that over, a woman named Diane Kullo, about whom questions have been raised as well by the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. But regardless of that, it's one of the least transparent media organizations you can think of in that regard. And let me be clear, there's supposed to be something of a firewall separating the agency from the newsrooms that it helps to fund and oversee. And that's written into statutory protections. It is written into the what's called authorizing language that helps to fund these guys. And it's Senator Chris Murphy of Connecticut, after one of our stories, proposed new legislation just to make it very clear that the agency CEO and his top executives are not journalists and therefore not allowed to reach into the newsrooms to influence news coverage other than setting very broad strategic aims and directions, because that will affect the integrity of the news report and the respect that it's afforded abroad. That is, it would undermine the mission of Voice of America and these other broadcasters if they were to come into disrepute by trying to inveigle his way into their decisions, which I've got to say is precisely what our reporting shows has happened.
Yeah, so let's talk a little bit more about the firewall, because it seems to me there's two different things here. There's a new head of agency coming in and replacing people or, you know, choosing different people to occupy various positions, which seems, you know, if you just saw that sort of in the abstract, seems like a reasonable thing to do. The other element, though, that we have here is, it's, correct me if I'm wrong, but the whole point of having the sort of more independent sort of structure of these various entities that comprise the US AGM is so that there is that firewall where the news coverage itself isn't being sort of politicized. And so the pointed question, I guess, is, you know, is the coverage that these entities are doing, is it now being politicized because of these changes with management? Like, are we there yet? You know, do you see that as a goal here? Is that something in the future? Or is that not part of it? Is that something that's just kind of like things, something people are really fearing right now, but hasn't really happened?
I think the effort's being made. And I'm hearing sort of mixed in terms of what the effects are. Let me say that you can go to the Voice of America and find coverage online and on their broadcasts. And let's be clear, it's not intended to reach American audiences, but with the way the web works, you can still see what's going on. And they're still covering the political race. They're still covering political, fractious political issues. They're still at times covering the controversies involving themselves, for which you got to salute them. So that's all there. I'm hearing from reporters that there's a lot more shying away from more controversial things, that there's tempering of language, that people are slowing down how much they file, because there has been a concerted effort by the CEO, Michael Pack, and a number of his top aides to influence, particularly Voice of America and the choices it makes. There were questions raised in the Urdu language service, which is intended to reach people in Pakistan. And there was a story done and on social media with video taken from a conference which Joe Biden made a presentation to in an effort to solicit Muslim votes. And the journalists involved were attempting to reflect to an Urdu-speaking audience that's heavily Muslim that American, major American political figures were reaching out and valuing Muslim votes. Now, questions were raised. Joe Biden was shown and making, in some ways, critical characterizations in passing about President Trump's agenda and President Trump's policies toward affecting Muslims. But President Trump wasn't shown addressing the group. Well, President Trump didn't address the group. And, you know, one of the things that journalists say at independent news organizations is not every story is going to include everything about every subject. You know, you judge the fairness of a story on its own merits, but you also judge it in the context of the fuller coverage provided by that news organization. Here, they're drilling down to individual tweets and saying, well, you're not providing a counter argument in specific tweets, which a lot of journalists say, oh my God, we will never be able to construct a tweet that fully contextualizes in 280 characters, both the political claims being made and the claims on the other side. So in the Urdu language service, four contractors had their contracts severed and an editor was suspended. It's not clear to me whether she's been reinstated or not. There were questions raised about coverage of Jill Biden and the introductory segue to a segment about her, about what she would be like, were she to become first lady, which followed by a day or two, a very similar segment about Melania Trump and her performance as first lady. They were essentially a twin set. But it was the introduction to Jill Biden, which said, well, this is what it would be like if Jill Biden were to become first lady. And the exception was taken because it was argued that it sounded as though they either assumed she would be the next first lady or that she should be the next first lady. Again, you know, you can argue about specific language, but remember a couple of things. First, this is intended for French-speaking Africans, not for American voters. The second thing is that you had essentially a senior counsel that is a lawyer, an investigative lawyer for the CEO, raising questions about this stuff. That is a very pointillist approach to looking at news coverage. I think the most serious incident involved investigation that this lawyer did, and I was able to confirm on many, many sources.
Sorry, when you say investigative lawyer for the CEO, you're saying this is someone who Michael Pack has on staff to sort of investigate the various entities or people in the entities of his own agency?
Yes, that's right. His name is Samuel Dewey. He used to work on Capitol Hill as an investigative lawyer for Jeb Harseling, if I'm pronouncing his name correctly, of Texas, and for Susan Collins. So he worked for a couple of Republicans. He worked on a number of investigations. He's been active in Washington political circles for nearly a decade. And he's been essentially tasked with going in and figuring out where he can identify anti-Trump bias in Voice of America's reporting.
So that I wanted to ask you specifically about, because some of your reporting did, and maybe this is one of the two senior political appointees that are investigating Voice of America's the White House bureau chief Steve Herman for supposed anti-Trump bias. Is this? Tell us a little bit more about that one, because that one seems to be the one that there was a fair amount of reporting on.
Yeah, so we were able to reveal Steve Herman, who's the White House bureau chief for Voice of America. In some ways, he is Voice of America's most prominent journalist, particularly in America. His stuff is presented on and translated into all kinds of different languages for all kinds of different services within the Voice of America, beamed around the world. And he's well known by Washington political journalists because he's very present. He's seen from peers that I've talked to at other outfits and other networks as a very straight ahead journalist. Sam Dewey, this 37-year-old lawyer for USAGM, who's a senior advisor and counselor for the CEO, Michael Pack, and Frank Wuko, a former Homeland Security official during the Trump administration, a former radio talk show host who trafficked widely in conspiracy theories, including completely groundless claims about Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, among others. The two of them compiled a dossier of more than 30 pages on Steve Herman's work, and particularly his social media feeds and Twitter feed. And they drilled down and they argued that if he was relaying the criticism of the president by others without countering it within the same tweet, that conveyed anti-Trump bias. Now, if you look at his feed, as others have, and as I have to a certain degree, you can see him relaying things from the president as well. But they don't take exception to that. They take exception when the president's side is not allowed to defend itself against criticism just simply in the tweets. And they argued to the acting director, again, somebody who doesn't have the job permanently with any job security, but they argued to the acting director that Steve Herman should be disqualified from covering President Trump and from covering the political campaign that the that the president has embarked in to seek re-election because of this proclaimed anti-Trump bias. So far, the director of the Voice of America, the acting director, hasn't done anything with it, but it's an incredible enduring source of tension and anxiety, kind of a sword hanging over the newsroom. What's going to happen and when? And according to journalists I've spoken to in a variety of different language services, it has served as an inhibitor from the kind of robust coverage without fear that they thought they might be able to do. It means that every time they're going to put up a tweet or something on Facebook or some other service or on their regular broadcast, they have to think hard. Do I need to have somebody rebut every element of a contention? If I'm doing an interview back and forth, is it enough that I'm pressing somebody on his or her claims, or do I have to have somebody else in that same segment? It affects the way in which you construct certain kinds of broadcasts and coverage. And while fairness is something for which all newsrooms should strive, and one which is by law mandated for Voice of America, the people enforcing that, you know, shouldn't be non-journalists if one puts any stock in the statutory and legislative protections that are supposed to be shielding Voice of America and its sister networks.
And so it just begs the question for me, you know, what, based on your reporting, what you were saying, you talk to a lot of people, what do you think is really the aim here? Is it another way for Trump to root out, you know, what he perceives as the deep state? Is it to like destroy the credibility of these entities so that they can't sort of do what they have traditionally done? Is it to turn them into sort of a more pro-Trump, almost propaganda arm internationally? Like, what is the goal with all of this, in your opinion?
I'm not sure all of those have to be mutually exclusive options. I think a lot depends, of course, on whether the president wins re-election not so many days from now, because that'll likely determine how long Mr. Pack enjoys tenure leading the agency. I do think that there's clearly the desire to serve as an exemplar, to serve as, this is what knowledgeable Trump leadership can do with an agency that otherwise seems to be a source of vexation from inside the federal government to the president himself. I do think that there's a desire to recalibrate or rebalance the scales and say journalism has inherently been unfair to President Trump, and we will show what a fair version of journalism will look like. I don't think it'll end up looking like Breitbart if Michael Pack has a full, you know, say 5-year term in office. But, you know, the prominence of editorials has been elevated. You know, that's where the U.S. government gets to basically say to listeners and viewers and readers of Voice of America, here's what we think. They've worked to elevate that and to make that more prominent. Now, that's always been part of the formula, but it's been left to the Voice of America to kind of figure out exactly how to fulfill the direction they've been given by officials in eras past. In this case, it's pretty clear. It's just all coming from the top. You know, if they want fairness for President Trump in every tweet, fairness being the chance to rebut every claim, and even if they're points of argumentation rather than points of fact, that's going to be a different notion of how things are presented. And it clearly is already making people gun shy there, which is part of the desire, is to inhibit people from presenting coverage under the aegis of something funded, and in fact, under the umbrella of the U.S. government, that is critical of the president. They haven't stopped doing that entirely. I would say that they're still trying to provide coverage down the middle. You see that from Herman, you see that from his colleagues, but I think it's tempered the ability of people to think freely. There's a lot of flinching that's going on even now, even as you and I are speaking. And I think that's very much part of the attempted effect as well. Those that are acting from Michael Pack on down may be sincere in their belief that the press is unfair, may sincerely believe that Voice of America should adhere to other different ways of embodying their mission and their standards. But if you look at the language and you look at the mission and you look at even the language that still remains on the USAGM website, the CEO is not supposed to be able to influence that, even through his top aides. It's not supposed to be able to reach into the newsroom. It's the same when I worked at the Baltimore Sun, the publisher, was not supposed to, and the corporate owner were not supposed to be able to reach in and say, you know what, I want you to do this different, slightly different emphasis on how you cover the mayor's race for the city of Baltimore. You just, that's how it's very hard to build up credibility and very easy to tear it down.
Well, let's talk a little bit about what pushback there has been from Capitol Hill, and there are also some lawsuits. My understanding is that the House Foreign Affairs Committee attempted to, after these firings happened by Michael Pack, attempted to have a hearing to, you know, talk about what was going on at USAGM, and they called Michael Pack, if I'm not mistaken, to come and testify. So what happened thereafter?
Well, he didn't show. You know, he was subpoenaed to appear, and he didn't show. So they decided not to enforce the subpoena legally, but it's certainly a sign of contempt. One of the interesting subplots was that he originally was invited and then subpoenaed to attend at that time. And then he decided to schedule, as I'm told by sources, administrative hearings for some of the executives he had been trying to fire and intended to attend himself, and said, oh, I can't attend your hearing because I've got these administrative things, which he only scheduled after receiving the demand that he attend the meeting on Capitol Hill for the House of Representatives.
Pretextual.
So it was pretextual. And a number of those people, I think, were intending to say, well, we can't make that time and make him suddenly be available for it.
One of the things that's kind of amazed me about this topic in particular is that there actually has been bipartisan concern and bipartisan pushback from Capitol Hill, which you're not seeing a lot these days. So it's another reason that I wanted to cover this topic on the podcast, because it's pretty remarkable, actually. Representative Mike McCaul, who is the Republican on the ranking member on the House Foreign Affairs Committee, joined with the chairman, the Democratic chairman, Elliot Engel, to issue that subpoena, and you know, rebuked Michael Pack for not showing up pursuant to the subpoena. My understanding is also fair amount of distress, even from Republicans on the Senate side, who were concerned about this sort of decapitation or mass firings and other things sort of going on at the agency. So, in your reporting, I mean, do you hear both from Republicans and Democrats on this issue?
Yeah, there are Republicans on the Hill. If you watched that hearing, they still held a fairly substantive hearing. And most of the Republicans were expressing their dismay about what they characterized as the damage to the mission that was being done under the leadership of CEO Pack. And Michael McCaul of Texas, the ranking member, as you say, from Republican on that committee, seemed to me to be pretty much just as concerned and just as outspoken about it as the Democratic chairman, Elliot Engel of New York. Similarly, on the Senate side, there have been concerns. So Marco Rubio has weighed in behind the scenes. Lindsey Graham has weighed in behind the scenes. You know, Rubio has very close ties with Jamie Fly, the man who was cashiered as the head of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. These appointments are not all of, you know, radical Bernie Sanders, you know, socialists in the way in which you might think from listening to the rhetoric of Michael Pack. So yes, there have been people antagonized. Now, you're not hearing about it a lot right now because everybody's in campaign mode. The Republicans in particular are very concerned about losing control of both houses on Capitol Hill. And this isn't a clear vote winner in either direction. It's a fairly obscure agency. But I think it's relevant because there are people who still care about and believe in the mandate and the mission of some of these agencies, because it's not a one where anybody's state is getting a ton of money or losing a ton of money. It's not one where there are natural opponents or advocates. It's more really fought out over principle and certain kinds of foreign policy arguments than anything else. And in this case, I think you see people on both sides saying, what have we gotten into here? Particularly Republicans who are asked to go along with the appointment and kind of want it to be non-controversial, right? If you go for somebody who's been held up for a long time that the president wants, after you give the president what he wants, you don't want to hear about it after the fact. Right. You don't want a headache over it. You want it to work smoothly. This has been as fractious, as intense, as bombastic a tenure as any you can think of in terms of a significant Trump appointee. And it really at the heart of it is very much about Trumpism itself, about the nature of his leadership, about the desire to kind of bend public opinion and public representation of himself to his will. And I think that's at the heart of this debate.
That is a really good point, and I want to end on that point. But before we do that, lots of lawsuits have been filed, as I understand, against Michael Pack for these things that he's done since becoming the head of the U.S. Agency for Global Media. Can you walk us through those lawsuits and sort of the status of them and their prospects?
I will do the best I can. You asked a little bit about what the pushback was. I neglected to mention there had been a letter of protest signed by 15 or so active journalists at Voice of America and another dozen or so retirees there and delivered to the acting director concerned about PAC. A lawsuit was filed by five of the top former executives who he intended to fire but ended up having to suspend because they have certain procedural rights that he was hoping to sidestep and ultimately is being held to. There was a lawsuit filed by the chiefs of the Open Technology Fund saying that he wasn't entitled to dismiss its board and to therefore appoint a new board on which he was to serve. And several of his aides were to serve, other Trump aides served, and an outside conservative activist he named to it, that he wasn't entitled to do that or to dismiss them or to sort of change, to withhold money. I think he's been withholding tens of millions of dollars from that fund to be able to do what it's supposed to do. The Attorney General of the District of Columbia also sued him in civil court, the District of Columbia Superior Court, and won a summary judgment a few days ago, arguing that he violated District of Columbia not-for-profit law in dissolving the board of the OTF and basically aggrandizing its powers to himself and his new board. They had already won was a preliminary injunction from him doing that. So essentially the old president of that fund was still running it, but running it kind of starved of cash and not knowing if she might lose. But this new ruling will, I think, bolster her cause and her status on that. There are a couple other lawsuits that I think are out there as well that I'm losing track of at the moment in my mind because there are so many things. There have been whistleblowers have filed grievances at the Inspector General's Office for the State Department, which is sort of a vestige of the fact that the agency used to be under the State Department. And also at another inspector general's office to argue that he has violated both procedural protections. He has that he is sort of abusing the security process. He has been violating the firewall. And one last thing we should leave your listeners with is that he sort of arbitrarily decided to withhold approval for visas for foreign journalists who on these foreign language services have been a vital component of being able to broadcast to all these disparate lands overseas. And he has made them not only financially very vulnerable, but a number of them are going to have to go back and live in their home countries where the regimes will not look in a friendly eye at the fact that they've done work for the United States government. And that there's real concern that they or their families could be subject to retribution. So you're seeing all of these legal challenges and these procedural challenges to the broad-ranging implications of what he has done and his essentially defenestration of people internally who have sought to block him or just to argue that there are other ways that things needed to be carried out.
You know, it strikes me that at least one of these suits, I think that there was a ruling in, it relates to, you know, his compliance with the District of Columbia's nonprofit law, which is the same body of law that there is, I think, the open investigation with respect to him personally and his, you know, pre-nomination time period. So it's just interesting to me that, you know, his questionable compliance with the district's nonprofit law is the subject that was keeping him from being confirmed, and it's now something for which he is being sued for. So,
well, let's put it this way: he was being sued by the same office, the Attorney General of the District of Columbia. They were over two different things. One was a question of whether he was allocating funds inappropriately to his for-profit that he got as a nonprofit, and the other is he taking over money from this government fund?
Right.
In both cases, you know, his willful disregard for the limits of his authority is impressive and imposing. And I think the question is the degree to which those people internally and those people he's forced out can serve as a check on that. I think that's what we're going to see play out.
So this brings us, I think, to sort of the final point, which is obviously the election's coming up. I think you've you've painted a bit of a picture of what will happen likely if Trump does win a second term. And I tend to agree with you. This seems to be just the first few steps, and then there would be more steps pursued if Trump is in office for another term. My question for you, though, is that, so say Biden wins instead. Is it reversible if Biden wins? These norms that have been broken, the people that have been fired or who have left, how do you see, or, you know, obviously you're a journalist and you know, so take it for what it is, but I'm curious what you think would happen if Biden did win. Would things go back to something that folks at this agency perceived as normal, or is it not possible now that they're all sort of gone?
I think a lot of people burrowed in and tried to stick around to hope to outlast PAC. And I think that's what he points to when he and others allied with Trump talk about the deep state, as they feel people should yield to my logic. It's my shop and I get to run it. And others say, you know, this is really bigger than any one administrator. These bureaucracies are actually living vessels of sense, and they outlive us all, and they should. And the question is, can you outlive it? My sense is, from talking to people internally, that there can be a lot of, from what their standpoint looks like, mischief that can be done between now and, say, late January, when the president, were he to lose, would relinquish hold on office. There's the belief that one could force out a CEO regardless of whether or not he wanted to relinquish the job. And we'll see how that looks. You know, there's only really been one permanent CEO prior, John Lansing, who happens now to be the CEO of NPR. And that's an important disclosure for me to make, although John doesn't get to influence or advise or know about my coverage ahead of time. We actually do have very strict firewalls, and we actually do observe them. I think that, you know, the muscle knowledge of the fear of political meddling will endure for a while. And it will require people making the conscious choice to assert their journalistic independence, even if it's inconvenient for a Biden presidency or Biden's imperatives abroad. You know, if they can break a story that proves embarrassing to a trade partner or an ally they need to get a diplomatic coup, they need to show they can do that. You know, it was Radio Free Asia that really helped to present to the world the oppression of Uyghurs in Western China. That may well have been done at a time when the president was talking favorably about China. That sort of thing could be uncomfortable for a Joe Biden as well in another country. But none of these things are written in stone ahead of time. People are going to have to consciously decide that they will persevere and do, you know, straight ahead and fearless reporting as best they can without anticipating and flinching ahead of time in the way that I think a number of journalists are now. I've been told that people are just deciding not to file stories because it's not worth it. So the coverage in and of itself may not be unfair or unbalanced or pro-Trump, but the decision not to do something, that's an editorial decision and withholding in and of itself. So I think that, you know, it's going to take time. And what the Biden administration would have to do, should the former vice president come to power, is decide that he's restoring authoritativeness and restoring an independence of judgment to places like the National Institutes of Health, to places like the CDC, to places like NOAA and the Weather Forecasting Service, and for that matter, to VOA and its sister networks. I think this is all of a piece of that, the knocking out the underpinnings of independent authority and independent judgment, whether or not they're perfect, which is not the issue here, you know, whether the ability to recalibrate the scale resides with political appointees, I think is the real sort of common thread in all these stories.
And I think we'll leave it there. Thank you so much, David, for coming on the Lawfare podcast.
You bet.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Don't forget to share the Lawfare podcast on social media and give us a 5-star rating and review wherever you found us. You can also purchase Lawfare merchandise at our online store, www.thelawfarestore.com. The podcast is edited by Jen Patya Howell, and our music is performed by Sophia Yan. Zachary Frank of Goat Rodeo was our audio engineer. As always, thanks for listening.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.